Hello there, folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with me, Dr. Brian Gurman, assistant professor of theology here at the university and the director of the Concordia Bible Institute. We've been making our way through Ecclesiastes, Qohelet, the gatherer, the assembler. And I know what you're thinking. Hey, chapter 12, that's the last one. What are we going to do next? Well, I'm wondering the same thing, but I'll figure it out soon enough. This is the last chapter. We've been through a lot of things, right? There's nothing new under the sun. We kind of batted that around a little bit. There is nothing better for man to do than eat, drink, and find enjoyment in toil. What does that mean? Well, we've talked about that a little bit. We are now on the last chapter. Some fascinating things going on here. I think in many respects, you probably remember, if you've been following along, you get the first three chapters of this book right and you're on a good path. I think in large measure, chapters 4 through 11 and into 12 really kind of expound on what happens in the first three. With that said, chapter 12 is certainly in that same camp. What you do with chapter 12 is absolutely huge for how you understand the book of Ecclesiastes. In fact, I was just thinking about this before I get jumping in here today, but that is, I had a class on this once. I took it when I was in grad school at a doctoral seminar on Ecclesiastes. It was fascinating. It's a few years ago, and I don't remember everything there is about that thing. In my finite brain, some of that has escaped. One thing that comes back to mind, though, as I kind of walk through this study with you, and now we're at the last chapter. We actually started with chapter 12. It was quite fascinating. What are we doing? Open up. Hey, welcome to class, day one. Here's your syllabus. Open up to chapter 12, and that was the first day. Now, it was just kind of a fascinating. So I kind of walked through. That was kind of a profound way to begin the book, and maybe you'll see why that may have been done as we make our way through it. But suffice it to say at this point, in many respects, what you do with chapter 12 is really largely determinative with how you handle the book of Ecclesiastes as a whole. With that said, then I'm excited to jump into the thing. I mean, I have, even before even looking into this in detail, chapter 12 just has so much going on that it's almost worth two podcasts. But hey, with that said, stop yapping and let's get to the text. So the text of Ecclesiastes, it should be doable. I mean, we're talking, 14? Yeah, 14 verses. Let's dive in and we'll see what we can make of this. So chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes reads as follows. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Alrighty, so there you have the text of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. This is a really interesting turn of events here. The theme, if you remember last podcast on chapter 11, we had a lot of this talk of joy. How can one be joyful in light of all these, the enigmas of life and the transience of life and all of that. Now, the theme is remember. First word, remember also your creator in the days of youth. So the key question here is how does, at least as we start, the key question, how does God as creator shape how we handle the enigmas of life? The vanity of vanities has its soft, how can we translate that? Hevel-Hevelim is the things that are, you can't grasp it, you can't control it, you can't get on top of it. Knowing that the Lord is your creator, how does that shape how we live in light of a life full of enigmas? Okay, that's really the key question of this first half. I want to definitely focus on the second half of the chapter, but let's walk through that first half just to see what we are getting into here. So remember the Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Yeah, I guess, you know, there's a sense we have to ask ourselves, what is he referring to here? And it's going to get a little bit tricky as we go along. But this first verse, I think, is pretty straightforward in terms of human life. The longer one lives, the more possibilities there are for enigmas, the more things you'll see that just don't quite, how do you navigate these waters right here? This is kind of weird. This is difficult. I thought conventional wisdom said this, but now I'm seeing that. Does the early bird really get the worm? I don't know. Let's bat that around a little bit, that sort of thing. And so before the evil days come, there's this sense in which, why do we baptize infants and this kind of discussion? And it's quite, there's a huge discussion, of course. And in the Lutheran Church, that is exactly what we do. And but there's a sense in which, well, of all the things that could be said, one thing is, well, what's with the adults? You have more years of being critical and skeptical, and you just gain more barriers, more stumbling blocks as you go along life between you and the faith. Oh, I got to work through this now. I got to work through that now. That's why faith like a child, right? Forbid them not, because of such is the kingdom of heaven. Without all the baggage, that's what faith looks like. And so there's this, everything evil stems from putting ourselves in the place of the Creator. I mean, think about the Garden of Eden, think about Adam and Eve, you'll be like God, you can be your own God. You take this, and that's the kind of temptation everybody has, and it just builds as you move along. So remember, before the evil days come and the years draw near of which you say, I have no pleasure in them, before you get so much baggage, if I can use that term, that it obscures what life before our Creator is all about. When you get into this next part here, verses 2 and following, several verses, this has actually kind of been debated throughout really the whole history of the church. I mean, centuries, three main views on this. I'm not going to get into all that, but whether or not to take it literally or is it symbolically or allegorically, it's just a kind of a mess. I'll kind of tell you where I lean here and I'll tell you why. But listen to the language first. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, sun and light, I often wonder how much Genesis is kind of hanging over this whole thing. And that is, I think it's happening here too. And that is, you'll hear the dust to dust. Later on in verse, 6 or 7, you'll have these allusions back to creation. And you have this cloud and rain, and you have all these, this imagery of, well, let's just keep going. Verse 3, keepers of the house. What does that mean? Well, keepers of the house, they're servants, but they have some authority too. You have the strong men as soldiers. You have people trembling for terror. The more you get into this, what else do you have? People looking through the windows, doors on the street. This kind of imagery, the more you get into this, the more this sounds like the kind of stuff that looking through the windows, as in your hopes are kind of dashed. The more you get into this, the more it sounds to me like the prophets when they speak about the day of the Lord. Singing of the birds in verse 4. I mean, this is when they're ready to pounce, when they found this is the corpse. This is where the vultures, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather, as our Lord says. Daughters of song, those are people who are mourning. And even you have even all this almond tree blossoming. That's it just fascinates me because that's the same thing you see in Jeremiah 1. He gets a vision. As soon as he's called, he gets a vision of an almond branch. And there's a play on the word there in the Hebrew, meaning I'm watching over my word to perform it. And so all the grasshopper drags itself along, desire fails, all this stuff. Nature is not even operating the way it should. Mourners are in the streets. Things are snapped. Golden bowl is broken. All this through from verses 2 to 6. It's just a mess. And I think the more I look at this, is I'm on the view of this is an illusion in Kohelet's own way, which he does have a way. I mean, there is kind of a very unique method to his madness, so to speak. And that is he alludes to things with just, with, I mean, such a subtle kind of illusion. It's not, sometimes he quotes, but sometimes it's just sort of, it's like he's testing his reader. How many clues will it take you to kind of hone in on where I'm, what I'm doing here? I mean, he's just kind of, he just writes with that sort of vibe. Well, anyway, the more I look into this, this is straight up, this is Day of the Lord language. This is a major catastrophe. This is not just, well, you know, like in verse 1, it was sort of, you start out by saying, well, you know, we're talking about a human life, and the longer you live, you know, that's what, but as you get into these subsequent verses, much more is going on than just, oh, well, you know, then one person who gets old then will eventually pass away. This is a major end time sort of catastrophe, and that is also why it's important to keep all this in perspective. So it seems like you start out chapter 12 with, like, this is just an individual's death, but yet it's connected to end times language throughout the subsequent verses. It's with that in mind that we'll kind of make our closing remarks just with this first half of the chapter. And that is where this verse comes. And I think a lot of commentators see this, and that's rightfully. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Okay, we have some work to do here. First of all is, well, the dust to dust thing. Where does that come from? Well, that's Genesis, you know. That's the curse comes along, curses the ground, cursed dust you are, and to dust you shall return. This is the Ash Wednesday of Kohelet right here. What do we do with this? Well, so the first thing to kind of say, oh, and then there's this other line. Okay, real quick, we'll talk about this line because this is still kind of a firestorm, and then we'll talk about how to make sense of this first half of the chapter. The earth, dust to dust, and then as the spirit returns to God who gave it. Well, what is Kohelet? Does he not believe in the afterlife? And is he saying that death is the end and things like that? Not at all. I don't buy it for a second. I think some people, the critical view comes along and says, well, Kohelet doesn't know anything about. Remember earlier, it was back in whatever, oh, here I am. Remember earlier that thing that was said someplace? I don't remember. He could have just said, Sheol, to which you are going. Who knows whether the spirit goes up or down? The beast thing. Remember an earlier chapter, what was it, at the end of 3? Who knows whether the spirit goes up or down, that sort of thing. This is exactly the kind of language that he could have used here, but didn't. It's very clear that Kohelet is talking about life after death when the spirit returns to God. He could have said down. He doesn't use the language of down. He doesn't use the language of Sheol. He doesn't use some of this more obscure kind of critical reflection language that we saw earlier in the book just to make his points. It's very clear the spirit returns to God who gave it. This is orthodox stuff. And then with that said, I guess the final question here is we'll tackle this and then take our break. It'll be a nice kind of a fit here. But this is the kind of, remember your creator. We start with kind of an individual's death, but Kohelet connects this to the bigger picture. It kind of moves the opposite direction. Remember, this first part of this chapter is really about remembrance as the possibility for how you make your way through the tension of life between joy. Talked a lot about that. Eat, drink, and find enjoyment. Previous chapter, chapter 11, joy and toil. The tension between joy and the tension between enigma, as in the ungraspable, the things can't be controlled, you can't master, that sort of thing. How do you, remembering your creator, remembrance is a way to walk through that. Okay, that's kind of the initial point that he's making here in this first half. In the second half, it'll be very clear how that kind of works itself out. But the key here, and I don't know if I'm being clear, and I'll say it this way, but the key in this first half is to say that the kind of exploration that he was doing earlier, this sort of autonomous behavior, I'm going to run around and just see what kind of things I can gather up, is itself a kind of forgetting. The opposite of remembering. It's a kind of forgetting who you are and a kind of forgetting whose you are. And that really, I think, is going to kind of bridge the gap to get us to the second half and really the last section of this book, where he kind of makes clear what he's talking about. So maybe that's a sort of quasi-cliffhanger, at least in my mind, to get you to stay tuned for the second half of this podcast when we return after the break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Righty there, folks. We're back with our study here. Isn't this exciting? I mean, we're wrapping up the study. It's kind of sad, too, isn't it? I mean, can we drag this along? Maybe we'll do another. No. But that's kind of, that's where we are. We're going to wrap this thing up. This is really, I can't wait to do it because I'm fascinated by how this thing concludes. I just think it's just so, it's profound. I always say that, but that's what it is. And we'll have to unpack that. So, buckle in, 6-7, what is it, verses, something like that. And here's how he concludes. So verse 8, chapter 12, verse 8, vanity of vanity, says the preacher. We've heard this before. So we have a few things to talk about. First of all, says the preacher, what are we talking about? Somebody else wrote this thing? Well, this is still debated too. So you have this kind of Solomonic figure, right? He's the one who writes this thing. But then we talked about this in the first chapter. Well, it sounds like there's sort of a framework, a frame narrative where somebody else, and this is, I kind of lean with Luther here. If I had to show my cards on the issue, I don't think it's absolutely horrendous if we grant that Solomon's disciples, if you hold to Solomon writing the whole thing, that's one option. If you grant that Solomon wrote the core of it and then his disciples kind of sort of like Baruch to Jeremiah, so to speak, had a framework for this. I mean, Luther himself was really one of the first to deny Solomon writing this book. And that's kind of a story in of itself. I can refer you to the first podcast that we did on Ecclesiastes for more on that. But either way, you have this sort of, wait, we're talking third person now. Okay, so there's a shift of some sort, however you describe the exact contours of that. Says the preacher, everything is vanity. Okay, so vanity of vanities. This is exactly what we started with. Now, I think, let me just say it up front, and that is, I think it's wrong to say this is his conclusion. I think that there's a little bit more sophistication in just saying, well, I said this before and I'll say it again, that's where I'm at. Well, yes and no. It's not a conclusion as in, this is where I stand. We have a lot more to say. He'll make it very clear where he concludes, how he concludes. But this recalls his main observation from earlier This is the exact thing. Vanity of vanities. Enigma of enigmas. I can't get things. That was like his thesis, his main point about what he was observing and when he set his heart to observe. So he's recalling that. He's saying, that's where I was before. And he's doing that for you here to say, this is like, these are like, it's an inclusio, a fancy literary term. It's like two identical doors at opposite ends of the room. It's the exact same measurements. It's the exact same wood. It's the exact same words and all of that. But we're at the other side of the room now. It's the exact same door, but it's not. It's at the other side of the room. So it's the title. I kind of see it as the title of the book, but not the conclusion per se. It just doesn't do any justice to the complexity of the book. It flattens everything out to just look at that and say, well, that's what he said before, and so there's nothing in between. No. If anything, that I hope that these podcasts have made clear is that there's all kinds of rich material going on about life and about how to navigate through the tension between enjoying what you do and then the things that we can't understand. So that's where we're at with that. Okay, now, and then here we go, verse 9. This is where it starts. Now we're learning more about the preacher. Besides being wise, the preacher also see, that's it. That's it right there. Like the first question that comes up, I didn't get through the verse, and that is the pronouncement that Qohelet, the preacher, the gatherer, the assembler, is wise. Besides being what? Not. I mean, think about it. If whatever view you have of who wrote this, besides being a lunatic and being depressed and sitting around like a bump on a log all the time, depressed on the couch. No, besides being wise. This is like the end of Job, where you go through all this complaining, and then all of a sudden the Lord looks at him and says, I'm really upset at your friends because they haven't said anything that's correct about me. Not like my servant Job has. What you have uttered, he says this twice, what you have uttered is correct. Whoa, all that stuff? Job, the complaint, he's cursing his birth, he's accusing God of all this stuff. Yeah, that's all right. That's correct. That's wise. That's exactly, it's like Lady Wisdom too. You get in the Proverbs, there's Lady Wisdom, there's Lady Folly. So Lady Wisdom pops up in chapter 2. She has permanence, life. Her way is the way of life, and Lady Folly is the way of death. This guy, so Qohelet is, the preacher is wise, and he teaches the people knowledge and weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. Now, this is going to be translated several different ways. It's really, I mean, some of the most intriguing Hebrew I've come across is how you translate this conclusion to Ecclesiastes. I'm looking at this as he always taught the people knowledge. He listened and deliberated and proverbs, and he put in order. He arranged many proverbs. He was constantly involved. He was very deeply interested in pondering, in listening, in gathering. Again, that's what his name, Kahal, gather, Qohelet, the preacher. And what he gathered, this has all the marks of somebody who is sincere, who is committed, who's hardworking, creative, and very interested, very loving toward God's people. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. This is not just, you get another product of a more critical view that came up since the Enlightenment, was to just look at Ecclesiastes as it was just a mess. And the only way it could be salvaged, if somebody came, like an editor came along and wrote like a, kind of a, made it kosher, or put an orthodox ending on to say, here's a stamp of approval. And as if there was nothing in the book that was kind of salutary, so we need this endorsement, otherwise it's not going to make the cut. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and he rightly wrote words of truth. I'm looking at something like he sought to find words of delight, yeah, and he correctly wrote down words of truth. So both the form and the content, both the form, delightful words, his Hevel Hevelim, vanity of vanities, enigma of enigmas, and also the content. He wrote truth. He has words of truth here. It's a way of saying that the journey was legit, if I can use that term. What Qohelet went through is truthful. He knows a thing or two about the enigmas of life. He knows a thing or two, but he's now on the other side. he now has he's gone through the journey. This is the fascinating thing about this. This is the first part of this second half of the last chapter. And that is, even if you end up in the exact same place, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. We heard that beginning, now we hear it at the end. You understand the whole thing more fully for it. The pleasure was in the journey. It's the, again, this is like Job. I heard of you by the hearing of the ear. Now my eyes see you. I know you in a whole new level. I know life at a whole in a whole new way, even though I ended exactly where I began. This is endorsing the entire book in a way that says this, there's some profound wisdom here. Throw this in the wisdom section of the Bible too. I got more to say about that, but I want to make sure we get to this. So the words, and then we have this, the words of the wise, as in this kind of stuff that's even written in this book. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. So the goads, the words of the wise, they prod us and they press us and they poke at us now and then to get us into wise action as well, to emulate the kind of living, the kind of life that Kohelet puts on display in Ecclesiastes, eat, drink, find enjoyment in toil, and so on. The one that knows how to navigate between pride and despair, between the indulgent kind of joy and the sorrow of enigma. And that'll get us to nails firmly fixed, like to a place that holds us. There's stability there. It's firm, it's solid, it's sure. There's, I don't know, maybe not, goads I read once were even used by shepherds. So that's the kind, because they're given by one shepherd. Shepherd, there is one shepherd. The Lord is our shepherd. It's pretty clear from elsewhere that I myself am the shepherd of my sheep. So that's a very, very prominent imagery there. But again, the sheep need the prodding with this kind of material too, because Ecclesiastes is so real to life. You need to know this kind of thing too, because we know about the enigmas of life. We know about the things we can't control. We know about the things that are outside of our grasp. But we need prodding in that, poking and prodding in our own way as sheep. Otherwise, we'll run ourselves into the ground one way or the other, either into pride or despair. We'll run ourselves into the ground in the same way that Kohelet almost did when he just set his heart to know wisdom. Is it over here? Is it over there? He kind of, you know, had his own sort of trial and error. But just like sheep need prodding, otherwise they'll ruin their pasture, they'll ruin their health. So also that we need the kind of wisdom that comes from the source of all wisdom, from the shepherd, given by, so that's given by one shepherd. I mean, this is straight up orthodox. My son, okay, now this is really intriguing too. My son, be aware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. This is a fascinating statement. There's really nothing like it in the whole Old Testament. Oh, what do I mean by that? Well, the word here, I mean, it's kind of, it's beyond them, my son, be warned. One can make books without limit. Too much study, too much discussing wearies the flesh. Don't tell it to my students, by the way. But so here we have, it's the words here in the context you need, whether it's instruction or warning. And I think the translations that use warning are correct. That is, they honor the context better. Here we are warned against going beyond the kind of thing that we have in Ecclesiastes. In other words, what we have in this book is sufficient for the kind of wisdom that it claims to proffer. Which is kind of fascinating. Well, it didn't stop you, Kohelet, from writing your own book. But this is a kind of sufficiency. This is the end of John. If everything were written about what Jesus did, I suppose the world itself could not contain the books. And this is the end of Revelation. If anybody adds or subtracts to this thing, the curses will be upon them. This is the end. This is completely and utterly reliable for its own purpose. In other words, Ecclesiastes is so good, you can't improve upon this sort of thing. This is the best stuff around. This is it might be a chapter on irregular verbs, whereas Proverbs, you know, you get your nouns and all the regular stuff. This might be irregular, but it doesn't get any better than this. In fact, if you want to try to improve upon it, it will beat you down. Weariness of the flesh. Much vexation. In fact, this is the end of the matter. Verse 13, literally the last word. That's what it says. The last word, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. What does that sound like? Well, right away, fear God. What's the beginning of wisdom? Go to Proverbs, first page, the fear of the Lord. Kohelet ends exactly where wisdom begins. He ends precisely where Proverbs starts. This isn't some crazy book that's out to contradict Proverbs and all these other things. Kohelet is going on this journey, and he's saying at the end of it, he says the same thing he learned when he was a kid growing up in catechism class. He didn't find any genuinely new sources of meaning out there, but yet he went on that journey. This is like the T.S. Eliot wrote about that. The end is the beginning again. Only you understand the thing more fully now. The Bible's so down to earth, it knows a thing or two about how life works and how to navigate through the tensions that Ecclesiastes presents to us. So fear God, keep his command. Well, so there you have the wisdom, fear God, which itself comes from other books, and then also keep his commandments. Well, what are we talking about, commandments? Well, now we're talking in the realm of Moses and Deuteronomy and all that. This is the Torah. So in this ending, we have one more verse to do still, but in this ending, you see a connection to the most conventional foundational wisdom and law in the nation of Israel, in the scriptures of Israel. It doesn't get any better than that. How does that affect our reading of the book? Well, you see what happens here. This kind of ending prevents Ecclesiastes from being ripped out of the Bible and going off on its own way and slapping down some weird, bizarre, unorthodox teachings. This is exactly like, this is why, so as much as you have to understand passages from Ecclesiastes in the context of the chapter and then of the book of Ecclesiastes, here's a passage, perhaps more clear than many others in the Bible, that ties it to an even larger corpus of literature, the wisdom, the law that's elsewhere in the Bible. In other words, listen to Ecclesiastes, give it its voice, but hear that voice in the context of the much larger choir that is the Bible. I mean, that's what I tell to my students, and that is, play the contrabassoon. It's an instrument, very low. Very depressing, ominous, low. Has a way of speaking about the depths. All right? Now you cue up Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Picture that in your head. Maybe it'll get stuck in your head the rest of the day. You're welcome if it does. Beethoven is, that's a very clear, it's triumphant. Dun, 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 dun. It is joyful, I mean, joy, right? Ode to Joy. It's joyful. It's triumphant. It's victorious. Beethoven used the contrabassoon, that deep instrument, bar, 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 in that symphony. It has a voice. It can be heard on its own. It can be appreciated. It should be heard and talked about a lot, regularly. And yet when it is, remember that it also takes place in a much bigger context. It also is one part of a much bigger, clear, uplifting, victorious message of joy that comes in Christ our Lord. This is the beauty of Ecclesiastes. It knows the enigmas of life. It's, yeah, practice the contrabassoon. Take lessons and talk about it. But always remember to hear that in the larger choir of how it contributes to the overarching message. The end of the matter. This is, it's also a warning, as in, don't be digging around elsewhere. What we have here is sufficient and will never be improved upon. This is the brilliance of how this thing ends. God, this is the whole duty of man. Literally, it's like this is the what it means to be human. There's no word for duty there. That's usually inserted. It's added. For this is what it means to be human, or this is what life is all about. It's not going to get any better than this. That's the same thing with John's gospel. It's booked up. You can go find all kinds of, there are other things. I think John knew that there were other records of Jesus. Well, somebody wrote about the kind of carpentry he did. And so, and there's, oh, here's comes some of these, maybe Jesus was married. Here's a fragment claiming Jesus was, John said, look, there's all kinds of things circulating about Jesus, but these things have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ and that by believing you may have life in his name. There's a sufficiency in what has been written there. And so also there's a sufficiency here in Ecclesiastes. Everything about what it means to be fully human is appropriately given here. Fear God and keep his commandments is literally, that is every person. That is the whole of a person. Early church father Irenaeus once said that the glory of God is the human being fully alive. And the end of the matter is that there is no more meaningful life available under the sun than that life which fears God and keeps his commandments. In that sense, Ecclesiastes is the world into which Christ enters so that we can be fully human again. Fascinating book of the Bible. I hope you enjoyed it. I sure did. What a journey it was. Tune in next time and we'll study the next topic, whatever that happens to be. But that, as you can tell, is all the time that we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. Thanks very much for tuning in. Please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they too can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. You can also find us on Facebook, leave a comment, a topic you want to study, a particular book. I'm open to those as well. Let me know what you think. Finally, this podcast dedicated to my Aunt Lydia. Love you, and thanks very much for listening as you do. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.